content note, there's just possibly a bit of deeper philosophical musings and concepts and some mentions of, like, abandonment issues and maybe xenophobia, or I'm sure there's a few other things, but there's nothing that should be too difficult, but I never know what something is or isn't difficult for someone to hear, so erring on the side of caution.
And we do apologize, but the glitching is very bad this week. Yeah. We've had a lot of rain and the internet's not playing, but we've done our best to make sure that the read itself is mostly glitch-free.
Hi, folks. This is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Today we continue with Madeleine L'Eng's A Wrinkle in Time, Chapter 11, Aunt Beast.
Ultimate chapter.
Ah, is it?
According to my Kindle, it is.
Excellent. So, Dave, we were discussing before the podcast that we would maybe draw in our listeners and get their insights.
Okay.
Might even put a Twitter poll up. Actually, that might be an idea.
Oh, yeah, that worked. So basically, those of you who are regular listeners of the podcast have noticed that with increasing frequency in 2022, we have been having to postpone updates. You know, we're usually out on a Monday afternoon. I believe it's Brisbane time. Monday afternoon, Brisbane time, kind of, sometimes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Usually around 2 o'clock. Yes.
Right.
Afternoon.
But yeah, due to, you know, emergencies, due to medical things, due to energy,
weather.
Due to weather. God, like, actually, conversation today, geez. We've had flood rain again for the last 2 days. Like, I thought this was done. What the heck?
Yeah. Our internet also tends to... So because of the way it is, internet is affected also by weather. If there's a lot of rain, if there's a lot of high winds. I mean, we've got a leak in the house right now. It's nothing compared to what people are going to through with flooding. But it's even in places that are not directly flooded, that we're having issues with the weather.
It affects our ability to create the best podcast we can. You know, in the content note the last few weeks, I have chimed in that there may be excessive glitching during the episode. And because we are, you know, due to the pandemic, we are still recording remotely. And the software we use, well, I don't know if it is actually the fault of the software we use. I want to blame our internet. Basically, often, you know, when Rue is reading, I'll have to ask her to re-record lines because there'll be like lag jumps and like, I call them glitches because you'll just kind of go, and you know, you'll miss a word, you'll miss a couple sentences. Is I mean, we've always had connection problems, but because we don't do this live, we've been able to redo what we've said and edit around them, and all is good. But yeah, with especially since it started the hefty rain over, I'd say the last month and a half. There have been more issues with recording and with editing. It has actually made editing a much more laborious process. Anyway, to make a long story short, so we've not been able to maintain our weekly schedule. Now, last time we recorded, which was a couple of weeks ago, Rue and I discussed this beforehand because I had a couple possible solutions to the problem. But after talking over with Rue, as things happen, I don't know if I actually, these are good ideas or not. So today I thought, hey, we've got maybe 3 possible ways forward for the podcast, and it might be best to get your feedback as the listeners to which one you would prefer. So,
you know, it's a really funny, it's not an aside, it's kind of related. I think I might have mentioned it on the podcast last time, or I might have talk to you directly about it. But I've been doing this, I did a course and I was attending a seminar on something. And one of the things that we were talking about was how you expand understanding and cause shift in cultural shift or cultural change, or are open to creating insights or forming insights in discourse. So you have discourse and then you derive insights, and that might lead to application that can further refine things. One of the things that came up was that there's a bit of a trap in a mentality, and I mean, this is not entirely relevant, but it is, as soon as you said this solution, like presenting solutions, when we go into something with the outright, here is the problem, here's the solution kind of thing, it often means that we don't necessarily know whether, you close off the process of identifying new insights. It's a strange thing. Yeah, so solution.
No, I understand, you know what I mean? Exactly, yeah. Where you're coming from.
Yeah, problem solving and solution orientated thinking, it can be a barrier to actually developing insights that create lasting change, is the word. And it's nothing to do really with a podcast determining what works for them, but it's interesting that mentality, I wonder how that translates also in these spaces of those micro decisions. Like, how do we, but yeah, so the idea that was raised was that it gets proposed to the listeners, which of the following options that we can think of.
Well, yeah, we have three possible solutions. And actually, after we've laid out all three, folks, if you have other ideas, please let us out.
Please. But I will put a Twitter poll up as well. But yeah.
It's interesting thinking, because that's usually the idea is, you know, you start with kind of infinite potential. And then when you start making decisions and start walking down a path, like other paths have to close off to you because you're aiming towards this one thing.
But at the same time, it means that if you have a more adaptable approach, like we're not focusing so much on the solution, but we have to understand what is actually going on, what the different options could be, and then what leads to what has generated those options. Again, this doesn't entirely apply to this kind of scenario where it's a little bit more time management and release schedule and whatnot. But in other spaces, you could see how if you only focus on one thing, you might miss out on other things. You miss out on looking at a situation from a broader scope, and then you end up with that tunnel vision or that siloing off of healthcare. If you only treat healthcare from one perspective and only focus on one aspect of it, you miss out on a whole bunch of other things. And it's interesting. It's the simplification. It's reductive and simplifying, which is okay for some things, not so okay for others. For the sake of the podcast, it's okay. Because we're just saying there's three things that we think might work for us. And then we're leaving it open also for you, dear listeners, to make suggestions and ideas you might have. I mean, Dave, if you want to outline the three options to our listeners so they can...
Okay, so number one is... we proceed how we have been. Now, the reasoning behind this and why I'm leading with we're not changing a thing is even though we don't hit our weekly update schedule, I guess there is a comfort in knowing that we are aiming for a weekly update schedule. And at least when I listen to podcasts, the podcasts I listen to, I enjoy the fact that it's like that weekly comfort. Now, you know, the reason I'm proposing these solutions at all is because I realize that we are not meeting that ideal that we've set for ourselves. But maybe you don't mind that we're taking 1 or 2 weeks off every episode or two because we aren't able to record. You know, the funny thing, even though this has only really become a problem in maybe the last 6 months of the podcast, this has actually always been an issue. This is why when we started the podcast, we had about a 5-month buffer before we even posted the first episode, because we knew this was going to be difficult. This was going to be a challenge to hit that weekly update schedule, just because of who we are and the difficulties that life throws our way.
With commit commitments, health, unpredictable things. So that kind of thing does factor in. Like priorities, unfortunately, sometimes will take over.
Yeah.
So yeah, so the option was that we have either we continue as we have been.
Yes. We continue as we have been. We have the occasional we can't update this week for whatever reason, and we continue as normal. Second is maybe we move to a fortnightly update schedule. That might be more feasible. We're still kind of semi-consistent, but we have a little more leeway in just in case something does go wrong. Now, even before we started this today, I told Rue, now that I've said this out loud, I don't like this idea at all, personally, because I can foresee we give ourselves that extra week's leeway, and I can see that sometimes, maybe not often, but sometimes we will not be able to hit that update schedule. Yeah, and then
slip back into option one.
And I'd feel doubly bad because we made a shift to try and accommodate this issue. And then, we're back to where we started. Yes. Now, the third option is what I originally approached Rue with, which is that after A Wrinkle in Time is done, which we've only got this episode and then the next episode before the book is complete. And we will let you know what the next book is. But we'll go away, and in our time, in our own schedule, we will record the entire book, episode by episode, chapter by chapter. And then when it is done, we will start updating again, and you will at least get entire book, chapter by chapter, episode by episode, week after week, until that book is done, and then we will do it with the next one. Now, this might also have the added benefit that once we finish the next book and start uploading it, we're going to dive right into recording the book after that. And it might hit that we never have to take a break again, because suddenly we'll be building up a buffer again. Of course, that is saying that we'll never, have an issue again. That I think that's being very optimistic.
I think, look, it gives there's an advantage to having there'd be a hiatus, and in that hiatus time, dear listeners, those of you who may not have heard some of our other book recordings or other seasons, as we like to put it, might take the time to listen through some of those, and maybe take note of any growth you've noticed. I don't know.
And as they always say, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Exactly. If we're away for a few months every year, if we come back and when we come back, at least I'm going to get a full book uninterrupted from these folks.
There's that, or also that it gives you the opportunity to maybe in your own time read the book that we announced is going to be coming out. So that you've had a chance to also read and reflect, and then hear, if you haven't already read it, or reread it, I don't know. It gives you an opportunity to, I guess, reflect and hear those kind of a different perspective, the perspective that if you are a regular listener, you might want to hear. I'm not going to assume.
But the con of this idea is that it kind of goes against what a podcast is. The idea of you have these people you like listening to discuss things week after week after week.
And I think we'll maybe think of some ways that could be, like, if that option is the overwhelming preference, we can probably think of some other ideas that we can do, maybe not necessarily where we're reading books. But I mean, you can always catch Dave when he's live streaming games, playing through games, if that's your jam, if you're interested in that. It's on Saturdays, Brisbane time, 1 to 2. It's 1 p.m. to about usually 4 p.m.
Yeah, right? I try and do 3 hours depending on the game and depending on how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
That's a good point as well. We could definitely once a month or so do special episodes where we even watch a movie or a TV series and talk about that.
Well, we wanted to watch the TV versions of or at least the little bits of some of the books that we've previously read. So we could easily...
I ran an idea by Rue that maybe at the end of the year we can do a special episode talking about the books we've read in 2022.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, but that's more towards the end of the year. And I think we're going to be doing that no matter what gets picked or what we decide. Yeah. But, you know, just, I guess there is other options for regular so many books, so little time discussions, even if we have to go away for a few months to make sure a book happened. As you can tell from the amount of discussion we've given the third option over the other two, this is maybe the where we're leaning as the creators.
Yeah.
But I do also understand as a podcast listener myself that the comfort of that weekly interaction is, I think, is very important, and it's part of what the medium is. So I would understand having to wait. You might forget about us.
I think it's more that we also want to, solution versus insight. If we get insights from our listeners, you might come up with ideas yourselves. You might have suggestions as to what we could do. If we did go with the third option, what kind of things you'd like to have us do? Maybe, have a monthly catch up where people can even join in somehow in the conversation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We have lots and lots of what is it that you'd enjoy? What do you think that would be helpful? And I think, yes, a podcast is meant to follow a certain structure and a certain understanding. And at the same time, says who? We this is a moment where of maybe dynamic creativity, where listeners, you are most welcome to join in with our experiment of what this so many books, so little time space can look like. Mm. I feel there's a quote unquote formula or structure to podcasts. But again, that's maybe if a podcast is looking to fall into a certain niche or a certain kind of media product. Whereas we're just enjoying sharing these books and encouraging and nurturing conversations about these topics, so we can do it however we want to. And I'm not talking we as in Dave and I, I'm saying we as a whatever this community is that they're surrounding
us.
And I was just thinking, and if people aren't comfortable with the idea of people chiming in and adding, it's whatever, share that too. Say we'd rather it just be you two, and maybe we can give you guys, send a poem in and you read the poem and discuss it, or, ask a series of questions or 20 questions for Dave and Rue relating to books, preferably. Let's keep this professional, people. Most unprofessional professionals ever.
That's the thing. I just had this big opine about what podcasts are and how important the consistent schedule is. And what kickstarted this whole discussion off is that we have not been consistent with our schedule.
Yeah. For example, I would love to discuss with Dave and break his brain a tweet that I just posted before that you might find interesting. Apparently, there are some plants that can see.
Oh, did you post that earlier today?
Yes, I did. And I went, what? Because, plants having chemo attraction to light, sure. Plants imitating the shape of the leaves of artificial plants, that's something else. That's something. And apparently they have like lens-like sensors. Not all plants. Hashtag not all plants. Sorry. So it's not all plants. Sorry. Apologies. I blame my ADHD for that one. It's not all plants. This is a particular plant that is known to have chameleon-like properties, as in it imitates plants around it, which if you've got other plants biologically around, like plants around you and imitating them, that made sense to the researchers. But then they're like, wait a second, how is it imitating how? And then they went and they tried it out with, can it do it with artificial? Oh man, it can. What is going on with these? Like, what's going on? And it turns out there's like lens-like structures on the surface of this plant that are processed and cause adaptation and change in the shape of the leaves and color.
Well, you know, there was an old, old SNL sketch when Christopher Walken hosted the show about how he was a gardener who was scared of plants because he didn't like that the fact that plants didn't have eyes, so he couldn't know if they were looking at him or not. So he put googly eyes on all his plants. And Basically, the whole sketch was just an opportunity to get Christopher Walken to say googly eyes as many times as they could. But
funny.
I remember that sketch.
And
it relates to this. But
give us random things. You could do that. We specialize in random conversations.
Well, the reason I talked about this before, one of the reasons I went to Rue with this podcast idea is because when it comes to just being able to discuss anything, she is one of my friends that is most suited for that purpose.
There's a handful of us that just, I'd say we tend to, it's funny, so just with neurodiverse populations, those of us who are neurodiverse tend to flock to one another. So you've ended up with a lot of us in our friend group that are autistic and or have ADHD. And it relates, it ties in, it's great. So yeah, we have, some of us have specialized knowledge in one particular topic here and there, like in our pet topics, but then also very scattered kind of interests, extreme directions of our interests, I guess.
And we all actually, now that I think of everyone who kind of forms the circle, we all have the ability not only to bounce onto completely different topics and then come back, but we all seem to have the ability to follow when that happens with everyone else.
Most of the time, yeah. Once in a while, we'll have a bit of, some of us are just fatigued, and so we're like, I'm going to zone out now. Is that okay? But that happens. I've hung out with our friends and I was just physically wrecked for this is a few months, years of this. And whenever I was completely physically wrecked, I'd literally just be comfortable being around my friends and fall asleep because I couldn't stay awake. And it wasn't because I wasn't interested or wanted to be there. It was just my body said, hi, you're going to crash now.
It's good to listen to that, your body, when it tells you that.
Yeah, and at the same time, I think I'm hoping that my friends in my circle are also comfortable. I mean, I know the ones that are okay with that, and no one's so far been, as far as I can tell, not okay with it. I think I'm hoping that within our friendship circle, just very openly, I'm hoping that everyone knows that there's no real judgment if that kind of stuff is needed.
Mm.
I think everyone has a really good understanding of that human bodies are complicated and human minds are complicated and life is complicated. And to just, I think there's a little bit of grace and understanding that does tend to circulate. In fact, it's only judgment that we react not so well to.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's great.
Well, I think it is time to move into the book portion of the podcast.
Well, this is why I brought up judgment. Can you tell? Segue.
What? Is this because Mr. Murray was being harshly judged?
Mr. Murray was being harshly judged. The creatures on the planet that they had landed on was being harshly judged. were being harshly judged. Let's recall their description.
Oh, yes, tentacles on, like tentacles that were off tentacles.
Yes. So, and also the planet or wherever they've landed is really like brown, everything looks really blah.
Oh, and they have kind of indentation-like things which they thought were faces, but then when they were talking, it came out of the tentacles.
Yeah. So they've got, there were three creatures that look strange. They had dull gray color as the flowers. So remember, the flowers are just gray. The grass is brown. If they hadn't walked upright, they would have been like animals, but they walked directly towards them. They had four arms and far more 4 arms and far more than 5 fingers to each hand. 4 arms, far more than 5 fingers to each hand. The fingers were not fingers, but long waving tentacles. They had heads and they had faces, but where the faces were actually far more than human faces in Uriel, these are far less. So there's just indentations.
Mm.
And their hair were, instead of ears and hair, they had tentacles.
So yeah,
they're very tall.
My imagination went, you know, for indentations, kind of, I thought their face maybe looked a little like Easter Island statues.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some really good illustrations people have come up with.
To be fair, maybe I'm being judgmental, but I don't want to see them.
Just basically, they look very unusual and strange. And Mr. Murray, side note, he should be a Dr. Murray.
Ah.
But anyway... Mr. Murray, he's a little bit guarded, and as is.
But he is answering all of Calvin's questions about what happened.
Yes, he is. And Calvin is, well, I mean, he's guarded towards the creatures.
Oh, yeah.
Calvin, in the meantime, is our communicator and is trying his best. Meg is injured in some way, paralyzed, and is in very cold and in severe pain. And is feeling like that darkness has almost held on to her.
Because when she was being nasty to her father, the book let us know that this was an influence of passing through the dark thing.
Yeah, that it was amplifying all the things that she was upset about and angry about. And so it was amplifying all those things really badly. And she was feeling afraid and upset and angry and all these things. And then as soon as... one of the quote-unquote beasts comes down, and she's also terrified. She thinks they're going to come kill them, they're going to eat them. Mm-hmm. It's in terror. One of the creatures crouches down and gets in contact with Meg, and then suddenly, for a moment, the pain is reduced.
Mm.
And she was sleepy, and she falls asleep. And then they take... and one of the creatures... carries her, and also one of the last one of the thoughts was before she falls asleep, I must look as strange to it as it looks to me, she thought drowsily, and then realized with a shock that of course the beast couldn't see her at all. So this judge, we were having a reflection on how it's interesting, and this is why I was tying it back to judgment when we make these judgments and assumptions based on how we perceive things without actually waiting to... Like, the people on Kamazots looked like them.
Hmm.
But most decidedly were not, and did not behave like them, and did not have the same values, and did not have the same function or thought, even.
Hmm.
Capacity of independent thought. And were, even if there was a bit of regret, oh, a child, oh, no, oh, well, you're going to have to... You must conform to our system.
Hmm.
Whereas here... There's these neutral creatures, neither hostile nor welcoming, and they're immediately thinking the worst of them because they don't... So immediately Meg and possibly Mr. Murray on some level are thinking the worst of these creatures based on their appearance.
Yeah.
So judgment is...
Well, also, I don't want to judge them too harshly for their judgment because they just escaped quite a devastating scenario.
Yes, yes. And that's the other thing. It's like there's a lot of... Sometimes especially when we make judgment and it's tainted with fear and trauma and pain, we can... I think the importance is the difference between judgment and discernment is information and our consciousness of how our internal... state and circumstances are influencing our perception of a situation. So there's awareness, for example, of that. If you have an incident that has maybe left you with a bias towards a certain population, and rather than kind of going, "Oh, I never could be biased. I'm the most subjective person there possibly is," you're going,
"Well, that's the thing about." Maybe propaganda is the wrong word, but it was like, you know, intelligent people believing conspiracy theories or, you know, believing falsehoods or getting sucked into cults, that kind of behavior,
yeah.
is that often intelligent people, and I say that with air quotes, are the most susceptible because they're able to say to themselves, well, I'm an intelligent person and I reason myself to this point. Therefore, I can't be wrong.
Yeah, in the case, there's also the whole idea of I've made decisions based on this framework of thinking, and now I can't deal with the consequences of actually correcting.
Yes, lot of shame and guilt. Also, I guess we've talked about this before in regards to other books, but one of the dangers of many folks, I've had to fight it a lot in my life, but the idea that, even though I'm being emotional, I'm not being emotional, I'm being rational.
Yeah, there's the thought of being rational when you're not. And then even what is rational?
Mm-hmm.
Who defines rational?
You know, often it came up just recently, and I'm amazed that this doesn't come up more, but, you know, with our current internet discourse, but thinking back, that was kind of one of the main conflicts of the original Star Trek. You had a being of pure logic next to a human who let his emotion get away with him. And often they worked in tandem. You know, it wasn't that one was better than the other, but...
Yeah, it is a great, the original premise, but there's also the thing that gets pointed out to the creature of pure logic, that they're not a creature of pure logic.
Because they had a human mother, was it?
Yeah, human mother. But also, not that we want to go down to the Trek lore too much.
Maybe we should course correct.
I'm just thinking. Also, there's this whole concept of that it's not that there is no emotion; it's that emotion is selectively put aside,
yes,
and excluded from the discourse of thought. Whereas emotions serve a purpose.
Yeah.
You can't, it's not that you should dismiss and cut out emotion in your decision making. It's that you need to consider, is this an emotion that is informed of how I am affected by a situation, or is this an emotion that I'm having in thinking about what the potential consequences could be for others?
Well, and also
empathy
just...
Empathy is a word. Empathy is an emotion.
Being honest as well, because we are always feeling all the time. That's just what we are.
Yeah. Yes. And there's a thing like when you are confident in a decision, that's an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
If you can look at the justification behind why you are confident, that's trying to use evidence to support your to justify. Mm-hmm. But then determining how valid a certain level of evidence is. And ranking it when it's not coming from to pretend there's no emotional impact there either, or effect influence either, is not right. So it's you're more, I think it's healthier. And in this case, in coming back to the book, yes, they've had their trauma. Yes, they've been going through things. But look, they're in the middle of a very unfamiliar situation, and the fact that Meg at the end goes, huh. I must also look strange to them and go, oh, wait, they don't see it all. So then go, okay. So there's just that being a little bit more, thinking more outside of yourself and not constant, because the fears when they were talking about them was all about, we're going to get killed. They're going to hurt us. Them, bad, 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 us, safe, make us safe. So that it was clouded. It's a clouded kind of way of thinking.
And the ability to actually, do that in the moment leaning towards explaining her power, because to be able to kind of take a step back, especially in the heat of the moment, is quite remarkable.
And that's the thing, and that's something that as human beings we are depends on where your priorities are, depends on where your education's at, depends on what your values are, depends on what your relationship with life. It's not just a simple, well, everyone should be able to do that. No, it's something that you train and develop, and you have to decide whether you're going to invest the energy and the time to train and develop, and how, and what does it look like. And so it's to assume that perfection is something that one that is achievable is another thing. So it's a whole big big can of topic, which is why I like the idea of, if you compare discernment with judgment is not always a complete picture, whereas discernment either has a more complete picture or encourages you to seek a more complete picture or seek further information before making a choice. Yeah, so I think that's the it's an attitude and relationship to attachment to being right. It's interesting. Yeah, and dealing with the consequences. But so now...
Yes, let's get into the book.
So Mr. Murray stood up quickly. What are you doing? And the answer was, taking the child. Yes? Chapter 11, Aunt Beast. No, Mr. Murray said sharply. Please put her down. A sense of amusement seemed to emanate from the beasts. The tallest, who seemed to be the spokesman, said, We frighten you? What are you going to do with us? Mr. Murray asked. The beast said, I'm sorry, we communicate better with the other one. There you go. He turned toward Calvin. Who are you? I'm Calvin O'Keefe. What's that? I'm a boy, a young man. You, too, are afraid? I'm not sure. Tell me, the beast said. What do you suppose you'd do if three of us suddenly arrived on your home planet? Shoot you, I guess, Calvin admitted. Then isn't that what we should do with you? Calvin's freckles seemed to deepen, but he answered quietly. I'd really rather you didn't. I mean, the Earth's my home, and I'd rather be there than anywhere in the world. I mean, the universe, and I can't wait to get back. But we make some awful bloopers there. The smallest beast, the one holding Meg, said, And perhaps they aren't used to visitors from other planets. Used to it, Calvin exclaimed. We've never had any as far as I know. Why? I don't know. The middle beast, a tremor of trepidation in his words, said, You aren't from a dark planet, are you? No, Calvin shook his head firmly, though the beast couldn't see him. We're shadowed, but we're fighting the shadow. The beast holding Meg questioned, You three are fighting? Yes, Calvin answered, now that we know about it. The tall one turned back to Mr. Murray, speaking sternly. You, the oldest, man, from where have you come, now? Mr. Murray answered steadily, From a planet called Kamazots. There was a mutter from the three beasts. We do not belong there, Mr. Murray said, slowly and distinctly. We were strangers there, as we are here. I was a prisoner there, and these children rescued me. My youngest son, my baby, is still there, trapped in the dark mind of it. Meg tried to twist around in the beast's arms to glare at her father and Calvin. Why were they being so frank? Weren't they aware of the danger? But again her anger dissolved, as the gentle warmth from the tentacles flowed through her. She realized that she could move her fingers and toes with comparative freedom, and the pain was no longer so acute. We must take this child back with us, the beast holding her said. Meg shouted at her father, Don't leave me the way you left Charles. With this, a burst of terror, a spasm of pain racked her body, and she gasped. Stop fighting, the beast told her. You make it worse. Relax. That's what it said, Meg cried. Father, Calvin, help! The beast turned toward Calvin and Mr. Murray. This child is in danger. You must trust us. We have no alternative, Mr. Murray said. Can you save her? I think so. May I stay with her? No, but you will not be far away. We feel that you are hungry, tired, that you would like to bathe and rest. And this little... What is the word? The beast cocked its tentacles at Calvin. Girl, Calvin said. This little girl needs prompt and special care. The coldness of the... What is it you call it? The black thing? The black thing, yes. The black thing burns unless it is counteracted properly. The three beasts stood around Meg, and it seemed that they were feeling into her with their softly waving tentacles. The movement of the tentacles was as rhythmic and flowing as the dance of an undersea plant, and lying there, cradled in the four strange arms, Meg, despite herself, felt a sense of security that was deeper than anything she had known since the days when she lay in her mother's arms in the old rocking chair and was sung to sleep. With her father's help, she had been able to resist it. Now she could hold out no longer. She leaned her head against the beast's chest and realized that the gray body was covered with the softest, most delicate fur imaginable, and the fur had the same beautiful odor as the air. I hope I don't smell awful to it, she thought. But then she knew with a deep sense of comfort that even if she did smell awful, the beasts would forgive her. As the tall figure cradled her, she could feel the frigid stiffness of her body relaxing against it. This bliss could not come to her from a thing like it. It could only give pain, never relieve it. The beasts must be good. They had to be good. She sighed deeply, like a very small child, and suddenly she was asleep. When she came back to herself again, there was in the back of her mind a memory of pain, of agonizing pain. But the pain was over now, and her body was lapped in comfort. She was lying on something wonderfully soft in an enclosed chamber. It was dark. All she could see were occasional tall moving shadows, which she realized were beasts walking about. She had been stripped of her clothes, and something warm and pungent was gently being rubbed into her body. She sighed and stretched, and discovered that she could stretch. She could move again. She was no longer paralyzed, and her body was bathed in waves of warmth. Her father had not saved her. The beasts had. "So, you are awake, little one." The words came gently to her ears. "What a funny little tadpole you are. Is the pain gone now?" "All gone." "Are you warm and alive again?" "Yes, I'm fine." She struggled to sit up. "No, lie still, small one. You must not exert yourself as yet. We will have a fur garment for you in a moment, and then we will feed you. You must not even try to feed yourself. You must be as an infant again. The black thing does not relinquish its victims willingly." "Where are Father and Calvin? Have they gone back for Charles Wallace?" "They are eating and resting," he said, "and we are trying to learn about each other and see what is best to help you. We feel now that you are not dangerous and that we will be allowed to help you." "Why is it so dark in here?" Meg asked. She tried to look around, but all she could see was shadows. Nevertheless, there was a sense of openness, a feel of a gentle breeze moving lightly about, that kept the darkness from being oppressive. Perplexity came to her from the beast. "What is this dark? What is this light? We do not understand. Your father and the boy Calvin have asked this too. They say that it is night now on our planet, and that they cannot see. They have told us that our atmosphere is what they call opaque, so that the stars are not visible. And then they were surprised that we know stars, that we know their music and the movements of their dance, far better than beings like you who spend hours studying them through what you call telescopes. We do not understand what this means, to see." "Well, it's what things look like," Meg said helplessly. "We do not know what things look like, as you say," the beast said. "We know what things are like." "It must be a very limited thing, this seeing." "Oh, no," Meg cried. It's the most wonderful thing in the world." "What a very strange world yours must be," the beast said, "that such a peculiar seeming thing should be of such importance. Try to tell me, what is this thing called light that you are able to do so little without?" "Well, we can't see without it," Meg said, realizing that she was completely unable to explain vision and light and dark. "How can you explain sight in a world where no one has ever seen, and where there is no need of eyes?" "Well, on this planet," she fumbled, "you have a sun, don't you?" A most wonderful sun, from which comes our warmth and the rays which give us our flowers, our food, our music, and all the things which make life and growth. Well, Meg said, when we are turned toward the sun, our earth, our planet, I mean, toward our sun, we receive its light, and when we are turned away from it, it is night. And if we want to see, we have to use artificial lights. Artificial lights? The beast sighed. How very complicated life on your planet must be. Later on, you must try to explain some more to me. All right, Meg promised, and yet she knew that to try to explain anything that could be seen with the eyes would be impossible, because the beast in some way saw, knew, understood far more completely than she or her parents or Calvin or even Charles Wallace. Charles Wallace, she cried, what are they doing about Charles Wallace? We don't know what it's doing to him or making him do. Please, oh please, help us. Yes, yes, little one, of course we will help you. A meeting is in session right now to study what is best to do. We have never before been able to talk to anyone who has managed to escape from a dark planet, so although your father is blaming himself for everything that has happened, we feel that he must be quite an extraordinary person to get out of Kamazots with you at all. But the little boy, and I understand that he is a very special, a very important little boy. Ah, my child, you must accept that this will not be easy. To go back through the black thing, back to Kamazots. I don't know. But father left him, Meg said. He's got to bring him back. He can't just abandon Charles Wallace. The beast's communication suddenly became crisp. Nobody said anything about abandoning anybody. That is not our way. But we know that just because we want something does not mean that we will get what we want, and we still do not know what to do. And we cannot allow you, in your present state, to do anything that would jeopardize us all. I can see that you wish your father to go rushing back to Kamazots, and you could probably make him do this, and then where would we be? No, no, you must wait until you are more calm. Now, my darling, there is a robe for you to keep warm and comfortable. Meg felt herself being lifted again, and a soft, light garment was slipped about her. Don't worry about your little brother. The tentacle's musical words were soft against her. We would never leave him behind the shadow. But for now, you must relax. You must be happy. You must get well. The gentle words, the feeling that this beast would be able to love her no matter what she said or did, lapped Meg in warmth and peace. She felt a delicate touch of tentacle to her cheek, as tender as her mother's kiss. It is so long since my own small ones were grown and gone, the beast said. You are so tiny and vulnerable. Now I will feed you. You must eat slowly and quietly. I know that you are half starved, that you have been without food far too long, but you must not rush things, or you will not get well. Something completely and indescribably and incredibly delicious was put to Meg's lips, and she swallowed gratefully. With each swallow, she felt strength returning to her body, and she realized that she had had nothing to eat since the horrible fake turkey dinner on Kamazots, which she had barely tasted. How long ago was her mother's stew? Time no longer had any meaning. How long does night last here? She murmured sleepily. It will be day again, won't it? Hush, the beast said. Eat, small one. During the coolness, which is now, we sleep. And when you waken, there will be warmth again, and many things to do. You must eat now and sleep, and I will stay with you. What should I call you, please? Meg asked. Well, now, first, try not to say any words for just a moment. Think within your own mind. Think of all the things you call people, different kinds of people. While Meg thought, the beast murmured to her gently, No, mother is a special, a one name. And father you have here. Not just a friend, nor teacher, nor brother, nor sister. What is acquaintance? What a funny hard word. Aunt, maybe. Yes, perhaps that will do. And you think of such odd words about me. Thing and monster. Monster, what a horrid sort of word. I really do not think I am a monster. Beast, that will do. Aunt Beast. Aunt Beast, Meg murmured sleepily and laughed. Have I said something funny? Aunt Beast asked in surprise. Isn't Aunt Beast all right? Aunt Beast is lovely, Meg said. Please sing to me, Aunt Beast. If it was impossible to describe sight to Aunt Beast, it would be even more impossible to describe the singing of Aunt Beast to a human being. It was a music even more glorious than the music of the singing creatures on Uriel. It was a music more tangible than form or sight. It had essence and structure. It supported Meg more firmly than the arms of Aunt Beast. It seemed to travel with her, to sweep her aloft in the power of song, so that she was moving in glory among the stars, and for a moment she, too, felt that the words darkness and light had no meaning, and only this melody was real. Meg did not know when she fell asleep within the body of the music. When she wakened, Aunt Beast was asleep, too, the softness of her furry, faceless head drooping. Night had gone, and a dull grey light filled the room. But she realized now that here on this planet there was no need for color, that the grays and browns merging into each other were not what the beast knew, and that what she herself saw was only the smallest fraction of what the planet was really like. It was she who was limited by her senses, not the blind beasts, for they must have senses of which she could not even dream. Well, since they can read her mind, I would assume so, yes. And sense her emotions. Again, I would assume so. She stirred slightly, and Aunt Beast bent over her immediately. What a lovely sleep, my darling. Do you feel all right? I feel wonderful, Meg said. Aunt Beast, what is this planet called? Oh dear, Aunt Beast sighed. I find it not easy at all to put things the way your mind shapes them. You call where you came from Kamazots. Well, it's where we came from, but it's not our planet. You can call us Ikchel, I guess, Aunt Beast told her. We share the same sun as Los Kamazots, but that, give thanks, is all we share. Are you fighting the black thing? Oh, yes, Aunt Beast replied. In doing that, we can never relax. We are the called according to his purpose, and whom he calls, them he also justifies. Of course, we have help, and without help it would be much more difficult. Oh, who helps you? Meg asked. Oh dear, it is so difficult to explain things to you, small one, and I know now that it is not just because you are a child. The other two are as hard to reach into as you are. What can I tell you that will mean anything to you? Good helps us. The stars help us. Perhaps what you would call light helps us. Love helps us. Oh, my child, I cannot explain. This is something you just have to know or not know. But we look not at the things which are as what you would call seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Aunt Beast, do you know Mrs. Watsit? Meg asked with a sudden flooding of hope. Mrs. Watsit? Aunt Beast was puzzled. Oh, child, your language is so utterly simple and limited that it has the effect of extreme complication. Her forearms, tentacles waving, were flung out in a gesture of helplessness. Would you like me to take you to your father and your Calvin? Oh, yes, please. Let us go, then. They are waiting for you to make plans, and we thought you would enjoy eating. What is it you call it? Oh, yes, breakfast, together. You will be too warm in that heavy fur now. I will dress you in something lighter, and then we will go. As though Meg were a baby, Aunt Beast bathed and dressed her, and this new garment, though it was made of pale fur, was lighter than the lightest summer clothes on earth. Aunt Beast put one tentacled arm about Meg's waist and led her through long, dim corridors in which she could only see shadows and shadows of shadows, until they reached a large, columned chamber. Shafts of light came in from an open skylight and converged about a huge round stone table. Here were seated several of the great beasts, and Calvin and Mr. Murray on a stone bench that circled the table. Because the beasts were so tall, Even Mr. Murray's feet did not touch the ground, and lanky Calvin's long legs dangled as though he were Charles Wallace. The hall was partially enclosed by vaulted arches leading to long paved walks. There were no empty walls, no covering roofs, so that although the light was dull in comparison to Earth's sunlight, Meg had no feeling of dark or of chill. As Aunt Beast led Meg in, Mr. Murray slid down from the bench and hurried to her, putting his arms about her tenderly. "They promised us you were all right," he said. While she had been in Aunt Beast's arms, Meg had felt safe and secure. Now her worries about Charles Wallace and her disappointment in her father's human fallibility rose like a gorge in her throat. "I'm fine," she muttered, looking not at Calvin or her father, but at the beasts, for it was to them she turned now for help. It seemed to her that neither her father nor Calvin were properly concerned about Charles Wallace. "Meg," Calvin said gaily, "you've never tasted such food in your life. Come and eat." Aunt Beast lifted Meg up onto the bench and sat down beside her, then heaped a plate with food, strange fruits and breads that tasted unlike anything Meg had ever eaten. Everything was dull and colourless and unappetizing to look at, and at first, even remembering the meal Aunt Beast had fed her the night before, Meg hesitated to taste. But once she had managed the first bite, she ate eagerly. It seemed that she would never have her fill again. The others waited until she slowed down. Then Mr. Murray said gravely, "We were trying to work out a plan to rescue Charles Wallace. Since I made such a mistake in tearing away from it, we feel that it would not be wise for me to try to get back to Camazotz, even alone. If I missed the mark again, I could easily get lost and wander forever from galaxy to galaxy, and that would be a small help to anyone, least of all to Charles Wallace." Such a wave of despondency came over Meg that she was no longer able to eat. "Our friends here," he continued, "feel that it was only the fact that I still wore the glasses your Mrs. Who gave you that kept me within this solar system. Here are the glasses, Meg, but I am afraid that the virtue has gone from them, and now they are only glass. Perhaps they were meant to help only once and only on Camazotz. Perhaps it was going through the black thing that did it." He pushed the glasses across the table at her. "These people know about tessering," Calvin gestured at the circle of great beasts, "but they can't do it onto a dark planet." "Have you tried to call Mrs. Watsit?" Meg asked. "Not yet," her father answered. "But if you haven't thought of anything else, it is the only thing to do. Father, don't you care about Charles at all?" At that, Aunt Bee stood up, saying, "Child," in a reproving way. Mr. Murray said nothing, and Meg could see that she had wounded him deeply. She reacted as she would have reacted to Mr. Jenkins. She scowled down at the table, saying, "We've got to ask them for help now. You're just stupid if you think we don't." Aunt Bee spoke to the others. "The child is distraught. Don't judge her harshly. She was almost taken by the black thing. Sometimes we can't know what spiritual damage it leaves, even when the physical recovery is complete." Meg looked angrily around the table. The beast sat there, silent, motionless. She felt that she was being measured and found wanting. Calvin swung away from her and hunched himself up. "Hasn't it occurred to you that we've been trying to tell them about our ladies? What do you think we've been up to all this time? Just stuffing our faces? Okay, you have your shot at it." "Yes, try, child." Aunt Beast seated herself again and pulled Meg up beside her. "But I do not understand this feeling of anger I sense in you. What is it about? There is blame going on and guilt. Why?" "Aunt Beast, don't you know?" "No," Aunt Beast said, "but this is not telling me about whoever they are you want us to know. Try." Meg tried, blunderingly, fumblingly. At first she described Mrs. Watsit and her man's coat and multicolored shawls and scarves, Mrs. Who and her white robes and shimmering spectacles, Mrs. Witch in her peak cap and black gown, quivering in and out of body, and then she realized this was absurd. She was describing them only to herself. This wasn't Mrs. Watsit or Mrs. Who or Mrs. Witch. She might as well have described Mrs. Watsit as she was when she took on the form of the flying creature of Uriel. Don't try to use words, Aunt Beast said soothingly. You are just fighting yourself and me. Think about what they are. This look doesn't help us at all. Meg tried again, but she could not get a visual concept out of her mind. She tried to think of Mrs. Watsit explaining Tesserin. She tried to think of them in terms of mathematics. Every once in a while, she thought she felt a flicker of understanding from Aunt Beast or one of the others, but most of the time, all that emanated from them was gentle puzzlement. Angels! Calvin shouted suddenly from across the table. Guardian angels! There was a moment's silence, and he shouted again, his face tense with concentration. Messengers! Messengers of God! I thought for a moment. Aunt Bee started and then subsided, sighing. No, it's not clear enough. How strange it is that they can't tell us what they themselves seem to know, a tall, thin beast murmured. One of Aunt Bee's tentacled arms went around Meg's waist again. They are very young, and on their Earth, as they call it, they never communicated with other planets. They revolve about all alone in space. Oh, the thin beast said. Aren't they lonely? Suddenly, a thundering voice reverberated through the great hall. We are here.
Ooh. Well, I gotta say, I have no idea how they're going to wrap this story up in a single chapter, but it does seem to be a very long chapter looking at the amount of book we have left.
Yeah, it's a good chunk.
Maybe we don't have to worry about having our answer from listeners next week because it might be a part two. We try not to do those. I don't think it will be, but you know, there's always a possibility.
You never know. Sometimes they can be a bit long. Yes.
I know you've read the story before, but what jumped out at you that time?
There's plenty of things. Like it's mostly interesting that there's this fixation on. Again, it's perspective. It's how we perceive reality. It's making assumptions about difference. This is one of the few moments where it doesn't feel like it's necessarily focused on the whole the whole underlying one of the topics being the whole communism versus capitalism, not capitalism, it was the dangers of socialism kind of thing. Like that's not really, actually not even socialism, it's the dangers of communism that this sometimes flags. That's not actually pointed out here. Like it's one of the few chapters where that's not relevant. At least I'm sure there's a relevance someone can see, but I can't see the relevance. The only thing that you're seeing here is the that all creatures have value and perception and like in terms of how we embrace difference, that difference can enable us to actually see something that we don't usually see. No pun intended, but it allows us to expand our insight. Again, sight. So it's interesting how many words we use in language. How many words in human language when it comes to relating back to the concept of understanding?
I mean, I don't know if I have the faculty to unpack this, but there did seem to be something in regards to our eyesight is such an important part of how we interface with the world.
Yeah.
And how that, as you just pointed out, that informs our language. And in both cases, at least what these beings seem to criticize in terms of how we communicate with, you know, how we interface with the world with our eyes and how we communicate with a simple language that is so simple it's been made complicated because we don't get to the truth of things. What I'm trying to get at, and maybe, I can't unpack, is it feels like the way we're built to interface with the world is superficial.
Yeah, and I think there's a beauty in sight, of course, and that kind of thing. But I think the way that it's, the way I'm seeing it, or the way I'm framing it from how, what is being framed, is that it's limited, and that we limit our ability to also communicate with others without relating back to how we see things. So our way of communicating, like in this case, it's trying to, it's using the example of you are meeting creatures that have never seen your kind of creature before, who don't have a point of reference, like the frame of reference that you are using. So how would you communicate with them?
And another frame of reference I think is important is humanity has never come in contact with another species from another world. You know, even at the end, that one said, oh, aren't they lonely?
And that kind of thing of if you, it's also like, it's a skill, it's a communication thing, it's a concept thing, it's a how you relate to something that is different thing. The fact that I like that she kind of, Meg kind of had that realization of, like, she still appreciates sight, that's not it, but that it's not, she goes, in this planet, it's not a relevant skill.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a relevant faculty. It's also that there are, our understanding of song is one thing, and then song has a different layer of depth to it in this particular scenario, right?
How they were eating some of the best food they ever tasted, and then Meg commented on how drab and unappealing it looked, and that reminded me how one of the sayings we have as humans is the first taste is with the eyes. We put a lot of stock in how pleasant the food looks.
Yes. It's, so there's all these layers to this particular chapter that are really interesting. Because if you sat down and you really broke it apart, there's so much, there's a lot of richness, I guess, in this chapter, because it addresses, concepts of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept of limiting by how we look at things and see things. There's a danger of making the whole, oh, and this is why we need to be colorblind. And you're going, no, this is why you shouldn't have prejudices that are founded in the appearance of another person. It doesn't mean that people don't have differences and can't be different and don't need, like, there's in context to their experience of life, and there's cultural context, there's how there's treatment, there's historical context, all these things, they are important and we need to consider it. But to just blatantly judge someone based on how they look.
Well, you said it before in the more abstract form, but don't judge people based on how you see the world.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the thing, like with the beasts, it's there's a common purpose in their community. Mm-hmm. So their planet, their purpose is we fight the dark. How? What are your allies? How does it work? Can't use the words to explain it to you, but yeah, so they can't use, there's the common words are missing in the how, but then the concepts are raised like, okay, love is the tool that we use. And similar things. So there are different ways to approach this, but that the common overall purpose exists.
Yeah, when Calvin came up with the idea that the Misses were like angels or messengers of God, the creatures started to understand, like get an idea of what they were going for. But like, okay, you're getting closer. You're still not there. We're still not really getting it.
So that means that it's trying to find the common thread is harder though if you only focus on what the difference is. So the fact that Meg only focused on the, it was trying to explain things but was still attached to her way of how she sees the world and how she understands the world.
Well, and again, it was that very superficial. She was explaining how they were dressed, you know, that had nothing to do with who they are. No. I mean,
and then she tried using other methods, which was like, okay, well, what they taught us. But then the way that they would have taught them things was also in the frame of reference that they understood. So mathematics, explaining, talking in terms of that abstract concept of mathematics, it's like, it was making it more and more complex and layered than it was, and still using things where there isn't necessarily a common ground.
Mm. Well, also, I was just thinking, I was about to, you know, hand wave away. She was just explaining the superficial, what they look like. But, you know, that is part of the puzzle. How a person chooses to express themselves is a part of who they are.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, and that's the tricky bit. But I think also the willingness to see things from the perspective, again, eye vision related concept, but like to try and glean understanding from how someone else explains or expresses their way. I'm trying to use words that aren't sight related, but our language uses sight related words. Perception. Yeah. Perception is related to sight.
Yep. Yep.
Insight related to sight.
Perspective is a drawing to turn.
Yeah. Perspective. You know, these concepts, it's fascinating that we, our understanding of knowledge and vision and like knowledge and understanding are incredibly linguistically wise, very much related to sight.
And look, this podcast itself, we're talking about books that you have to use your eyes. I mean, okay, there's Braille, there's audiobooks, but it is generally a vision.
Look, I wouldn't even use that, but the descriptions in books.
Yeah, what do things look like? Yeah, yeah. In fact, that's why when in a lot of the How to Write Better books I've read, they talk about, you know, bring the other senses into it. So rarely do you, you know, how something feels, how it smells. Yeah. We get sound. Sound's like a secondary because we, I think if vision is our primary sense, how we interface with the world, I think auditory is a close second, although touch maybe is up there too. Yeah. Hard to say.
And really, if you look at the previous chapter, look at how many times other senses are mentioned. The sensation of the fur.
Mm.
The lightness of the clothing or the warmth or the texture of the food.
Because she mentioned. Couldn't rely on her sight.
Yeah. So it was really, it challenges the reader to think beyond, to not be limited by one sensory input. But not only that, then the beasts go, well, actually, what about the things that are unseen and having understanding about the unseen? That's how we relate to existence. There we go. Relate is not a word that involves seeing. So relating to existence is by the things that cannot be seen, the unseen. And then it goes into this idea. And that's where, I guess, that's where you have the religious related context of that. That's the whole point, is to explore the things that are beyond the senses and to try and grasp what beyond the senses means. And those things that are beyond the senses that have an impact on our existence.
Mm.
That's where that goes in. And that's also where philosophy, you know, tends towards and whatnot. So that's the thing, like to think a bit, I think with greater depth. I like the fact that with the framing they put, like that we have a tendency towards superficiality in our language, but also in the way that we operate and function in our world.
Mm.
Oh, I don't like the look of that. You know, like, oh, just look, my schedule just looks really busy. Our relationship with different things, our priorities, our what affects us, how things affect us, all that. It's very interesting. Whereas if you think about it, love as a concept, we can think of, there were some things raised, feeling secure, feeling safe, not like the only falling back to when you're back to that idea of when you're in a state of being an infant, because when you're an infant to a certain point, you can't see properly. Your vision is extremely restricted. Your other senses are there's different effects, but feeling safe and secure, that's a thing.
And maybe more accepting of help.
well, you need help. There's no other thing. But yeah, so those things like vulnerability and it's one of those chapters that's rather, it's very cleverly crafted.
Mm.
And it just requires, like, you just keep going. You're going, oh, there's more layers here. Oh, there's more layers. Oh, there's more. So it just keeps going. It's one of those layers after layers after layers after layers. But it's, I don't know. I find it's a comforting chapter.
Mm.
And it has little splashes of humor here and there. And still, the pain that is being felt, the emotional tension.
Yeah, as they said, you know, because Meg is still acting out. And Aunt Beast did say that, you know, we've been able to heal her physically, but the spiritual attack, that who knows if that will ever...
Well, we don't know what the implications are. Mm. We don't know what the impact is. And those kind of things also take longer to recover from, because there's literally the trauma of your... Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about it before, going in and no longer having your parent as infallible, your parent being a fallible human being who makes mistakes, who sometimes muddles through life. And in this case, the one person who's been there consistently for her, who is Charles Wallace, the only one who seems to make her feel as though she can cope with the world that she has difficulties navigating in, is the one that is, you know, being that, that's the thing that's being stolen from her, first by it and then by the fact that they can't that they've had to abandon him, so to speak.
Yeah, it was also an interesting comment about how her father must be quite extraordinary, because we'd never heard of anyone escaping a dark planet before.
Yeah, to manage to actually do that is huge. So now the next question is going to be, we can guess.
Well, the missuses have arrived, or at least one of them.
Yeah.
Which, one of them has. Which I get the feeling that, you know, they're going to help, but based on who they are, they can't just go, here's what you need to do.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun. And Meg, I don't think is in a place where she can go along with that. So there might be some conflict there.
Yeah. She's got some emotional, she's currently, her emotional volatility is both because Meg is Meg. And also, I mean, she has some justified abandonment issues and sense of betrayal when it comes to her dad.
Yeah, that's true as well.
Like, it's legit. Like, it's a reasonable, like, it doesn't take much of a dig to kind of go, well, yeah, she's got abandonment issues.
Mm.
And they're reasonable.
Yep.
Father disappeared.
Yep.
Father also, when she overheard the conversation between Calvin and him, she would have probably been even more ticked off.
Mm.
You knew you had a family. You drew straws and that was that, and that was okay. And the person didn't come back, and you didn't stop to think for a moment that that would maybe be a reason why you don't
but volunteer. Mate, science.
We had to know. We had to know. We had to figure it out. It's like, okay, mate, your ego, pull it back. And that's why I'm a fan in science of very much having a very humble approach to science, because that, and I mean, that's what he eventually developed. Mm-hmm. He developed the fact that we do not know anything in relation to reality.
But he had to try the thing and get slapped down before that set in.
It's like the universe said, oh, that's cute. Smash. Mm-hmm. Wow. So I like that. Smacked down by the universe. That's what's happened there. Mm. And all these assumptions. It's been one of those things. Ooh, but yes. So, ow. As my voice just crashes, I think that's a good time to wrap up the delay.
So would you like to tell the listeners what the final chapter is called?
Yes, the final chapter, A Wrinkle in Time, at the digital book that I have, 188 of 206 pages, is called The Foolish and the Weak.
Hmm, quite an ominous sounding chapter.
It's a harsh sounding chapter, yes. Mm.
Now, next.
Sorry, just looking at the title, who do you think the foolish might be in reference to? I wonder, was it foolish maybe to just tensor yourself across the unknown time-space continuum because you don't know what's going to happen? Yeah, maybe a bit foolish. Maybe a bit foolish. So the music at the top of the podcast is Jeff Danner's score for the 2003 production of A Wrinkle in Time. Music at the end of the podcast is I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me on Twitter at RuMcMoo.
And I am over on Twitter at Dave_the_turret. You can find our Facebook page and Twitter profile at SMBSLTpodcast. And if you'd like to email us, it is smbsltpodcast@gmail.com. Now, we would really love to hear your feedback about what we should do moving forward, what you, if you would prefer us to keep the way we're doing things, or if this idea we have about maybe changing things and maybe doing some different types of shows would appeal more to you. And if you have other ideas of what that might look like or directions we can move in, we'd love to hear those as well. As always, as well, we would love to hear feedback on the book, feedback on the episode, and suggestions for new books we might be able to read in the future.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, we hope you have a great week, or fortnight, or look, period of time until the next episode has elapsed.
We'll see you next episode. Stay safe, folks. Enjoy your reading. Bye.